Good morning. We are welcoming Pamela Haynes, a member of Central Philadelphia Monthly Meeting, a writer, workshop leader, and speaker. She is passionate about the earth, relationships, integrity, paying attention, repairs of all kinds, and enjoys connection with Northern Ugandans, youth climate activists, childcare teachers, and urban farmers, among others. The author of Money and Soul, she has also written three Pendle Hill pamphlets, three volumes of essays for Quaker Quick series, and three volumes of poetry. Her blog and podcast can be found at pamelahaynes.substack.com. And today we're going to be talking about how the eMERGE values play a factor in what she has been so passionate about her whole life. It's the eMERGE values being empathy and mindfulness, ecological integrity, right action or resilience, growth, and endurance. So we are happy to have Pamela Haynes with us today. Good night, Pamela.
Oh, thanks, Bert. So glad to be with you.
Today, we're going to be talking about a number of issues and work that you have done over the years. I would say that you are characteristic of one of the values that we really treasure, and that is endurance. That you basically have followed your values in throughout your life on what as our values.
Thanks, Bert. I wanted to talk about a living economy for a livable earth. And economics has been just one of these things that's been a thread in my life ever since I was a child. What is it all about? And what does it mean? And what do we do about it? And I've discovered that a lot of people are really intimidated by economics, and they're made to feel too ignorant to understand or question or challenge. But I'm thinking about our Quaker community and how we feel like we have a right to step into the public arena around peace, even if we may not be experts, that we still have a similar kind of a ability to step into the public arena about economics, bringing our faith and values intact, and daring to imagine a living economy for a livable world. So as I've been doing workshops and writing around this, I distilled six big economic ideas, which I thought might be a good framework for this conversation.
One of them is to center and measure what we value. And I think that as Quakers, we spend a lot of time considering what it is that we truly value and wanting to place that at the center of our world and of our community. And how do you see that playing out in a larger community as you've studied it?
I think that there's a real issue of integrity here and a lack of integrity in our economic measurement systems. And the main one that we have is the GDP, the gross domestic product, which everybody's heard those words, but what does it actually involve? It includes the sum of all economic activity. And so we measure our well-being by the number, the GDP number, is the sum of all economic activity growing? But there's some really big flaws there, because part of what we measure, for example, is things that don't add to our economic well-being at all. Private prisons, that's economic activity. Predatory lending, that's economic activity. Cleaning up oil spills, that's economic activity. Then there's things like, I think about agriculture and big ag, for instance, and all the things in that industry that don't get measured. So there's the things that we measure that don't help us out, but then there are the things that we don't measure that get invisible. So with big ag, for example, we don't measure the pollution from farm machinery and transportation. We don't measure the impact of pesticides and herbicides on the damage to the soil, damage to small farms, farm workers, farm communities. All of those are out of that balance sheet and therefore perceived as externalities, like they're not measured. And we don't measure the work of caring at all. So we've got an extraordinarily flawed system of measurement that really needs to be changed.
Yes, and as you were saying, those things that don't get measured doesn't mean they don't exist. And somehow it's a mechanism for pushing off the cost on those to often those who suffer from, say, the waste products, the health effects of the manufacturing processes, things like that.
Yeah, we don't. And what is it? Our goal is to measure well-being, but we have this very, very narrow, we equate economic growth with human well-being, and that's just not an equation that stands. So we really need to be thinking about measures that really take into consideration human well-being. And there's some great models out there. The one that people talk about sometimes is the one from Bhutan, a measure of human happiness.
Yes.
Then there's one that was originated in France where people are pulling in the externalities, pulling in the pollution and all those issues in order to get a better actual number for the economic activity that actually helps people. There's others as well. So it's an emerging exploration of different ways to measure what we value that have more, it seems like they have more integrity.
I agree with that very much. It seems it's also a way of conferring dignity on those who are not as much a part of the linear production system, whereby it is something is produced at the end of that production. The profit for that goes back to the starting point, which is, say, resource extraction, and dealing with the waste goes to those who are deprived at a lower level. So how do you see replacing that more linear production method with more of a circular, say, a grave, sorry, a cradle to cradle kind
Yeah, yeah,
of
yeah,
economy?
yeah, yeah. I just wanted to say one more thing about the measuring what we value. If you do subsistence agriculture, then you don't get it. You don't, there's no economic activity necessarily. So that isn't even included in the GDP, but that's a lot of how people live. So there's, when you said that thing about kind of people at the bottom of the
Yes.
heap, it doesn't even include them at all. Feel like they don't exist. So that's weird. Okay, replacing linear with circular modes of production. I'm thinking about historically, like I really grew up with this story of the frontier and manifest destiny, and we can push west, and there's endless resources, and there's endless space, and going for more and more is just like the American thing to do. It's a very deep mythology, I think, that many of us in this country were ra raised with. And it actually worked when it looked like, well, when we didn't care about who actually was already living there, and there was a lot of space, and there was a lot of resources in the ground. But it's just so totally not a fit with a finite planet. Like endless economic growth on a finite planet, it's just a essential contradiction in terms. So we have to get so much, we have to kind of give up that mythology about endless expansion being possible and start. It's like a extract, produce, consume, discard, repeat.
Yes.
And then that's like the line that goes steadily up. And here we are, this one whole finite planet, and it just isn't a match. So it's again, there's a lot of people thinking about how to do this. Like how do we align our human systems with Earth systems? Oh, I have to stop 1 minute and say one of the things, a phrase that really struck me is that somebody said the economy is a total subsidiary of the biosphere.
So that's a very clear thought. Yes.
The economic system is a total subsidiary of the biosphere. It has to fit in with the biosphere. It has to.
Right.
So, yeah.
And it's very often not considered to be part of it. It's considered separate and
separate.
apart from.
Yeah, so you have to ch there's a lot of changing these really big ideas that are just inside our heads from acculturation, and just looking around and realizing the realities that we're facing. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that here in America, we are starting, that was our starting point, the frontier economy, that where, that we were, that is our ancestors, were willing to do all kinds of heinous things for to realize that economy, enslave a whole continent's worth of people as much as they could, to commit genocide on those who were residents here before. And it's amazing that that story, that ideal is still living on by those who are saying that we need to go to Mars, we need to go to the moon,
That's right.
places that are not livable for human beings to be.
Yeah.
But there is somehow some buy-in that is an acceptable way forward rather than treating this planet as our home.
Yeah. And the thing that I'm always looking for examples of there's problems, but where are the solutions? And there's a lot of energy around circular economy. We're talking a ton about renewables these days, but there's also really interesting experimentation with waste from one process becoming a resource for another. Like there's waste heat that you can bring it into the system again. Or there are things like, I can't quite remember the details of this, but it was like the wool from sheep that gets just thrown away because it doesn't have a something something used in a whole different process. And there's regions in Europe that are thinking regionally about what are the industries that are here, what are the wastes that they produce, what are other industries that could use those wastes as part of their process, and how do you integrate those systems? And then there's also the whole idea of building reuse and repair into design. And the whole thing about, like, maybe nobody should own a refrigerator. Maybe we should lease a refrigerator from the refrigerator company, and then they would be responsible for maintenance and disposal. So it pushes the responsibility for design on and repair and disposal onto the producer rather than just letting it be on the consumer and the government.
Yeah, it needs to rethink consumer because the
Yeah.
consumer has, I think, in many ways, many times, many products in relation to many products is thought of the consumer will be the end stage for this. As long as they can get their product sold to the consumer, that's where it ends.
Yeah.
But we have a lot, and they're a lot wasted at
Oh my
that
God.
level. Consumers aren't basically not empowered, not equipped to be able to take it from an end cycle of one product and into the next phase. That requires a much bigger grasp organization.
Yeah, and why not the folks who produced it in the first place? Be
Yes.
the ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Produce it was in the mind of it going on.
That's right.
And say, and maybe plastics is a say an ideal case in that case because many, if not all, plastics are not able to be recycled into something else. They are locked chemically into what they are, and it makes it very difficult. And it means that whoever is producing and utilizing it at the originators of it use other materials, develop other materials that can go
Can be,
into the
exactly.
next phase.
Yeah. And there's another issue around right to repair. This is a movement that started in Europe, but it's spread to the US now, that it's legislation that requires producers to give the consumers an opportunity to repair, because if you don't give them an opportunity to repair, then they have to throw it out and buy a new one, which is good for profits, but bad for everything else. But if
Yes.
there's been this big fight in out in the Midwest around tractors and farm machinery, and it's become more and more difficult for farmers to repair their tractors because they're sold ones that don't, that are complex and have kind of elements that aren't accessible to them either, or information about it that's not accessible. And so it's like, let us be able to repair our own tractors again. And I think that's a, that's another hopeful sign of it's, I guess that's the repair part of the circular thing that is, again, people are scratching their heads and trying to figure out how can we get a little more control over this system that's running amok.
I agree with that. And many friends experience that with their automobile. That I remember the time when most automobile owners could, at least in part, take apart an engine or fix things under the hood. And now it's computer driven, and there are advantages to that as we have gotten more and better mileage out of driving. But you can, an owner cannot do, and can do very little under the hood there to repair their car if something is not going right. And who knows? But one of the things that leads to is the idea of repair leads to the idea of the commons, and how there is the famous article about the tragedy of the commons, about how basically what held in common is not maintained, that we need private property for that. However, one of the things that happens that leads to that, and David Bollier writes quite a bit about this, what the first thing that got excluded from that is commoners, that those who have a sense that they belong to what is held in common as much as what is held in common belongs to them. And that kind of alienation leads to a distance, a distraction, and a ability for others who would look at it as a profit center to do what they will with it. And I was just wondering if you have thoughts about reclaiming the commons.
Oh my gosh, I love that idea of the commoners. I hadn't heard that before. And there's a woman, Eleanor Ostrom, has done really
Yes.
wonderful research on the maintenance of the commons, and that most traditional systems that have commons are maintained. So that famous article was a red herring, pretty problematic and big red herring. Yeah, so I think that the commons, I think that's maybe one of the most critical concepts that isn't probably in most economic textbooks, but that we need to bring to our understanding of a livable earth and a living economy. What do we share and how can we protect what we share? And so I learned about the commons with, I think a lot of us did, this 16th century English fencing grazing land, the grazing land that was once managed for everybody's animals was then became private property. It got moved out of the commons, enclosed and used to maximize profit rather than to maintain livelihood. And that was the breeding ground for folks having to move to the city in terrible conditions, industrial conditions, because they didn't have access to the shared land that they once had. And then you can think about the whole era of colonialization and the US, what happened in this country as an enormous claiming of the indigenous commons, enclosing an indigenous commons, that it's just an incredible thing that happened over the course of those centuries. That I think if we frame it in that way, that what was once commons that served for the well-being of the inhabitants, the commoners, becomes a private property for the purpose of private gain. And a lot of people think, well, that's all in the past. But in reality, there's a lot of issues around the commons that are very current. There's our air and our water. Those are things that are kind of a little bit easier to think about. But there's also the airwaves, the internet. There's also our DNA. Like, people are trying to privatize DNA for profit. It's incredible. And then, so there's those things. And then there's our public utilities, like our water systems, for example. Oh, somebody could do that more efficiently by being for profit, but it turns out that it's never good for the people who are the using those utilities. And we're certainly seeing that this whole data center thing is an enormous enclosure of commons for profit at the expense of the people who live there. So, go ahead.
I was going to say that, sorry to interrupt, it seems that there are a couple of values that are associated with the commons that are very important and getting trampled on. One is empathy for those who we share in common, as many of those things, all of those things that you were just talking about, and ecological integrity, because very often when you propertize, you make it a property, that gives whoever claims ownership of it to do wish as they wish, to the exclusion of empathy for those who are suffering, being left out of the equation.
Yeah, so I think that there's a really big frame that we can think with here and apply our values to reclaiming our private wealth from the rules of private ownership, so that we can manage our private wealth, our public wealth, for the public good. And if we have that frame, I think that we'll see a lot of things that are happening in the economy with a new clarity, with that frame around it. And I think whenever we're talking about the commons, oh, another kind of commons, libraries, for example, public libraries.
Yes.
Commons. So if we can use that word, really keep it someplace more in the front of our minds, I think that'll clarify a lot of what's going on and clarify a lot of the place where we can step forward with our values.
I agree. And I love that Pennsylvania and Virginia, as far as I know, Pennsylvania, Virginia, maybe Louisiana, are actually commonwealths, which means that was the spirit on which they were founded, that it was a wealth there and it belonged to all of the residents thereof. And one an important thing that we have in common with everyone and responsibility is money. That is seen as, that is a tool. However, it seems to be thought of as only the property of those who have it in their pocket. I was wondering what your thoughts on that is, are.
Money. I have so many thoughts on money, so many thoughts. One thing is that there's a lot of economics textbooks that don't even mention money. It's like they've got more important things to talk about or something like that. But we need money to live. So if you think about it, I think it's really interesting to think about money as a public utility. We need water to live. We need air to live. We need housing to live. We need food to live. We need money to buy the things, since we're not all in subsistence, whatever. We need money to live. And money, this is a thing that a lot of people don't know, how much money has been privatized for profit maximization. That we do, the government produces a little bit less than 5% of the money that circulates in the form of dollar bills and coins and things. But most money is actually created when a bank makes a loan. The bank determines that I'm likely to pay back a loan. I have enough good credit that I'm likely to pay back a loan. So they write a little entry in their book, and they write a little entry in my checkbook, and I have money. And that's basically how money is created in the world these days. And it is managed by banks, and it is increasingly managed by big banks, and it is increasingly managed for profit maximization. Talk about the commons. How do we reclaim our right to have what we need, to have access to what we need to live, and not have that be in the private sector? Gosh, there's so many things that could be said about that. So governments borrow money, like municipal bonds. When you float a municipal bond,
yes,
the city is raising money to do things for the common good, right? So they need access to cash to do projects. But then you have to pay back the interest. That's the thing. You have to pay back the interest. And when there's a lot of 30-year long-term bond projects, and the interest ends up being about half of what you're paying back, about half of that is interest. So it doubles the cost of a project, and that interest goes into the financial system. There's a really big issue about reclaiming money.
Yes, and one of those where you're talking about interest. Interest first, growth is probably the most, in my mind, the most problematic values within Emerge, that we have to find a way to make growth an internal spiritual value within ourselves to take out to the world there. Because if we think of it only in terms of dollar values and debt, right now, I think that the federal government alone, it's about 17% of the federal budget, more than Defense Department, more than Social Security. It's huge because of the borrowing that has gone on. It's predictable that it's just going to keep growing if it's never paid back, and there's apparently no intention to ever pay it back. And that's just ourselves at that happens at state, certainly at personal level also. So that we need work.
It's a crazy system when you think about it. Government borrows money from the banks to do the work, to do infrastructure and all these things it does. Then pays back interest to, now why does the government not have the to just spend money directly into the economy? We do that. We actually have done that sometimes. COVID just spent money, the economy, the government just stuff. If it does stuff, then it's not paying back, doesn't have to pay back. And so there's idea that it's fine for the government to just keep running a deficit because we don't have to pay it back. Maybe we're not going to pay back the principal, but we're paying back the interest every year. As you said, it's a really big chunk of our budget. And that it doesn't make sense. But
So
it's
is there,
good for people to think about.
for people to think about, yes, is there any way of developing money as a public utility that has a circular flow to it rather than out of one pocket and into another?
Oh my gosh, Bert, I'm so glad you asked that question. We have an example in the United States of America that hardly anybody knows about, which is the Bank of North Dakota, established in 1918 or 1919, when the farmers of North Dakota didn't want to see all of their profits going over to the big companies and banks in Minneapolis, St. Paul. They said, we want to keep the value of what we have produced here in North Dakota. So there was this populist surge, and they came into government and they created all these populist things, including a public bank. And then the conservatives took over and they went about dismantling everything. But then they came to the bank and they thought, bank, bank, maybe we want a bank.
Yes.
The bank has survived all throughout all these decades, and it now takes, it holds all of North Dakota's public dollars, it holds all of the tax dollars, all of the federal grants. And it lends mostly to community banks and credit unions throughout the state. It has a higher percentage of community banks and credit unions per person than any other state in the country because it's avoided this, the big bank buyout thing that has happened everywhere else. And North Dakota went through the 2008 recession without a tremor because they didn't have any money in Wall Street. All their money was in North Dakota.
Wow.
And all their money is being used to the benefit of folks who live in North Dakota. Isn't that amazing? This is just, it's happening. It's happening in that state. And it could happen anywhere.
And this is not talked about. It's not in the news. It's when solutions are looked for fiscal problems, that is never referred to as the possibility.
Yeah, so what happens with a public bank? Is that you can afford to loan out at a low interest rate because you're not trying to maximize your profit. And then the interest comes right back in to that whole system so that they actually end up, the Public Bank of North Dakota ends up supporting the state budget as well as managing the lending. And they've also, this is one, they mostly lend to the banks, but they also lend to individuals for student loans. And so they have low interest student loans in North Dakota.
It seems to be the circular economy at work in
There you
the
go.
financial
Circle,
area.
circle. Yep.
That is wonderful. And I think it has been very successful at, is it a low failure rate, a low.
Yeah, they run a very tight ship. They have hardly any defaults. And it's just an incredible story. Everybody should know about the Bank of North Dakota. Everybody in this country should know about the Bank of North Dakota. It's just such a great model that we could replicate. And there's similar models all over the world. We're way behind here.
I completely agree. I think that we are in kind of a medieval model in many ways. And one of them is around bankruptcy and indebtedness and lack of forgiveness around debts because, say, credit is extended beyond where it's rational, where someone might be able to get a loan that everybody at the table has a good sense that they might not be able to pay it. But say those extending the loan, say a banker, is says that we need to push this much money out the door in loans, and so we're going to take the chance on them. And the reason they feel they can do that is because the debts will just be a saddle on that person for the rest of their lives, possibly repaying that. Student debts are not forgivable, as far as I know. I was wondering what you think about how we can manage that better.
I think that you laid out the frame of it, but I think about it, the heart of it is that the nexus between private property, debt, and interest, and the focus on maximizing financial return. So that without government intervention through taxation, there's this really inexorable dynamic, which again, we don't see it very clearly, but since receiving interest gives folks who lend more, and paying back interest leaves debtors with less, it just steadily creates income inequality. And so as the regulations, as taxation of excess wealth has gone down in this country, oh my gosh, I just have to stop for a moment to tell another little fact that nobody knows, but I think is a
Okay.
real fact. In the 1950s, federal money tax, we have a progressive income tax structure. So all income above $250,000 was taxed at, you want to hazard a guess?
More than it is now, I don't know.
Yeah, it's about 38 or 39% now. It was 91%.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
91%. So the idea in the 50s was that if you had $250,000, which would be, I don't know how many millions in inflation these days, that was enough. That was enough. And the rest of it should go into the public, to go into the common pot, right? So that's really decreased enormously. And the regulations on banks and lending have also decreased. And we have these things like the credit card companies. We're doing exactly what you were saying of keeping people paying back interest. A lot of mortgages, a lot of what you end up paying back is the interest, not the value of the thing. And so the people who own the assets and who are the lenders are in steadily increasing their wealth, and the borrowers are becoming increasingly in debt. And we're really seeing that very clearly in this country now with the wealth inequality just spreading and spreading. And so there's the idea of canceling debt has gained traction. A story that a lot of people don't know, this has gone back a little ways, but there's a big move to cancel the debt of poor countries at the turn of the century. It's called a Jubilee campaign. A lot of
Yes.
faith groups got involved in this Jubilee campaign. So the International Monetary Fund canceled something like $37 billion, and nobody even noticed. There's no ripples on the on any international finance systems. It barely made a blip in people's consciousness. They just wrote it off. They just wrote off the debt. So there's a possibility of writing off debt That's really important. And there's a big issue these days with in the climate movement, with countries that are deeply indebted
Yes.
to the international financial systems and to the rich countries, that they're spending all their money paying back debt, so they don't have any money to do the climate work that desperately needs to be done there. So there's this a new movement, a little bit similar to Jubilee, saying we gotta forgive debt of these countries if they're going to be able to do the climate work that they need to do. And loaning them is not a good option because then they're going to be paying back the interest. So there's two things. There's one is debt forgiveness, but then there's another one of trying to change the system so that this private ownership of finance doesn't just pick up again and recreate that dynamic of increased inequality.
One thing that happens, I think, with debts is that it moves everybody more and more from a community to a collection of individuals, and at which they can feel more exploited and they have less ability to work together towards a common goal. And this happens at the us in the individual and family level here and the international level. Between countries, also. And it is not just we have, or at least I have in my mind, the picture of from the Middle Ages of someone in a dungeon cell in chains. But in fact, as with third world countries, this is not that as much as it's leverage, saying that you owe us this money, so this corporation has to be able to come in and mine these resources that otherwise you would not allow because of the tailings, the waste product that's left there, the exploitation of the population, but they are forced to do that because of their international debt.
And we think that somehow we have a right that we owned the money. We made them a loan. They agreed to pay it back. We're in the right somehow. But it's the system is so essentially flawed that we have to be willing to challenge that notion of ownership of wealth. We just have to rethink the whole thing.
I agree. That goes with property as money, but that also goes with our rights. We're looking at everything being an individual this, individual that, and we have shared rights also that are important for us to maintain ourselves as a culture and as a society, and those are being chipped away at also.
And one of the things that's so interesting is the role of corporations. You have this thing about a corporation is now a person. Weird, totally weird, because a corporation is for the pro to maximize the profits of the shareholders. It doesn't have any human capacities at all. But that corporations have gradually, they've amassed more rights than human beings. So this is again the property rights, the ownership, the individuality that you mentioned there. So they've got more rights than workers, than communities, than the earth. And so this shift, it's so important to shift our allegiance to shared rights. And if we're talking about shared rights, then we would prioritize human rights. I think that there's a good sense, or there's some international conversation about the importance of human rights. But democratic citizens' democratic rights, that's a real issue these days. Workers' rights, the rights of communities, the rights of communities to decide about their shared quality of life and the stewardship of their local environments. And this is another one that's a lot of people don't even think about. It was just starting to creep into public consciousness, the idea of rights of nature, that bodies of water, ecosystems, other species have rights to exist and flourish. So what if we were talking about shared rights, I think opens up a really big conversation and allows us a little bit of a sharper critique of the private property rights.
I agree. It's not humanism, but speciesism that we are so focused on ourselves as human beings. And we live in a biosphere, as you had spoken about before, that this is a biosphere and we live within it, not above it. And we're not at an apex of something in there. And We have to honor the rights of everything else that is existing to continue to exist.
Yeah. There's a lot of indigenous leadership that can be taken here, is not surprising. There's a movement in Wisconsin, I think, around wild rice, which is the staple of an indigenous community, and they're working to establish the rights of wild rice, which addresses land ownership and pollution and water and all kinds of things. So I think that being alert to the rights of nature and looking to opportunities to follow indigenous leadership is one of the hopeful ways forward here.
I agree. One of the definitions that I, as I understand it, about economics is the how to use scarce resources. And it starts from a place where we have plenty. And I'm thinking right now of the Ogallala Aquifer in the Midwest, which is being used down. It's drawn up. So now what had been a plentiful resource is becoming a scarce resource. And that it with the global warming is what we are facing. And we have to find a spirit in there that will allow us to work in community and honor the rights of others who may not be as powerful as we are here to live and to have their historic ways of life as resources become less.
Yeah, I think the circle becomes critical here again. We're like just keeping in mind that we have to move from that straight, ever ascending line to the circle. And it's just another frame that we could look at all these issues that we're trying to find our way through.
Yes, there is a model that I don't really fully understand. It's called the donut model
Yeah.
are you familiar with that?
Yeah, this is Kate Raworth, a British economist, created this way of thinking about economics as a donut, or our whole economic system as a donut. So picture the donut, a nice, juicy, maybe not very nourishing, but tasty thing. And it's got a hole in the middle, right? And then there's all the space outside of it. So she says, what if we think about the donut itself as our safe place for living? For all of humanity and maybe all of life. So she says the hole in the donut is where we're falling short on meeting human needs. And the space outside the donut is where we're exceeding the Earth's capacity to maintain its essential integrity. So that our goal, if we're thinking about how do we practice economics? Then our goal is to pull people in to the donut from that hole in the middle where they're struggling and pull the stop overshooting our capacity on the outside. And one of the things that's really cool about this model is that it links issues around debt and wages and healthcare and housing, which are people are have not enough of. To the climate issues around overextension, to we need to pull back on. So it's this a kind of a coherent way of thinking. There's towns now that are using this model. Okay, so we want to live within the donut. We have to address places where people aren't getting their needs met, and we have to address climate issues at the same time. It integrates the two of them in a way that's really, I think, is really useful. So if you're interested, look up Donut Economics or Kate Raworth and take a look at the image, which is a pretty powerful image, I think.
It sounds like it has a good way of explaining where we find ourselves and where we can go forward with this. And it also sounds like this is something that we can all participate in,
Oh, yes.
as it seems that any way forward is we will need many friends to be
Yeah.
involved with this. This is not a top-down thing. And I was wondering how you see a way of activating that and speaking to those who are waiting for just the right moment to become active.
You know what? I think about the roots of the word. My mother was really a Greek and Latin enthusiast, so we had conversations around the dining table about roots of words. So what is the root of economics? It's Greek, and it's the management of the home. the management of the home. And I think that maybe that's where we start, that we all know how to manage a home. We all know how to do the budgeting, and we know how to do the organization, and we know how to do the care. That if I think that the critical shift is for us to claim ourselves as experts and to claim our values as central to the conversation, and then to just look around and see where we can move that understanding outside of our families and probably for many people first into our communities, but then maybe more broadly than that. We can imagine a new thing. They're all over the place. And then we can speak out and we can act for a livable future for us all.
I certainly think that you are that as a model for action. And we are so grateful that you have been here with us today with your clarity and your scholarship and your spirit to share so much of what you know about where we are in our economy and our ecology and so many different points of intersection that affects all of us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, Bert, and I'm so grateful for the work that you all are doing on Emerge.
And thank you. And we're grateful for all the work that you've been doing. You are the personification of endurance. So thank you so much.
Okay. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you.